Okay, thanks. So, time is limited, so I'll have just a few short words of motivation before we get into the main business. Quantum field theory is something that I'm sure most of you recognize as being a central part of modern physics. However, one of the interesting things about quantum field theory is that in the standard beginning textbook presentation of quantum field theory, you typically work in Minkowski space. And in fact, you make heavy use of, say, the Poincaré group. However, one of the other important things we know about physics is that we live in a world with gravity. And therefore, we live in a world where space-time is, in fact, not Minkowski space, but instead is curved. For example, as Mark Trodden will remind us later today, we live in a dynamic universe, which is expanding and accelerating, and all kinds of things happen. We also know the universe is filled with stars and galaxies and black holes, other things that curve space-time and cause it to deviate from Minkowski space. So you might think that combining these subjects and studying quantum field theory in curved space-time is of interest. And indeed, as you may know, there are several fascinating classic results that come out of this subject. Just to list them briefly, there is the particle creation by changing space-time in the early universe. There is the spectrum of perturbations from inflation, a related but somewhat different topic than particle creation in the early universe. And of course, there are the famous Unruh and Hawking effects. Okay? So those are the kind of things you might like to understand about quantum field theory and curved space-time, and the kind of things that I would like to tell you about during this set of lectures. Now, unfortunately, as with the other courses at this school, time is limited, and I will not be able to go through everything I just mentioned in great detail. So it's therefore important that I mention two excellent references that are now available for the student of quantum fields and curved space. These are both sets of lecture notes from the last couple of years. One is by Ted Jacobson, and this is by Simon Ross. The references are HEPTH 03080848, but of course you'll find it by searching Spires under Jacobson. And this one is 0502195. Okay, I should mention that I've written up a list of references, of which these two are the leading candidates, and there are a few more, and it's been placed on the PI website. It's not currently on the website in quite the right place. I noticed this morning, just before my lecture, that the references for my course appear to have been swapped with the list of general references for the entire school, but if you look around, you'll figure that out. All right? However, correctly placed on the website under my course, next to where these references will be posted shortly, are two homework assignments that may be of interest to you. As with everything else in this school, homework is up to you folks, but whether you folks want to do it or not. Roughly speaking, the homework assignments I put up fall into two categories, just one and two. One contains various mathematical preliminaries that some of you may already know very well, and some of you may not. So I will go along throughout this course and cite various results about some rather straightforward mathematics. And if you don't know it and feel uncomfortable with my statement of theorems, conclusions, et cetera, you should work through the homework assignment in detail to construct all the proofs. That's part one. The second part homework assignment is, well, of course, once I'm done with my lectures, I've only gotten so far, and you'd like to push your knowledge a bit further. And so the second homework assignment will help you do that. For example, I mentioned that one of the important outcomes of quantum field theory in curved space is computing the spectrum of inflationary perturbations, which see structure formation in our universe. I will not have time to go through that calculation in detail in this course, but it does make a simple version of that makes a nice homework problem for students who have listened to everything I have to say. So if you work through the second homework assignment I posted on the web, then you can do the calculation for yourself, at least at a simple level. Okay. Question already. Good. Please. Speak more slowly. Okay. I'm rushing to the introduction. I promise to slow down at the technical bits. Okay, good. So let me just say what it is I'm going to do in this course. Roughly speaking, I hope to introduce you to the formalism for quantum field theory in curved space-time. What this really means is we're going to study what I would call covariant quantum field theory without the Poincaré group. Okay? And then what I hope to do in this course is give you a good understanding of what's called the Unruh effect, and then hopefully extrapolate to the Hawking effect. Great. I should mention my general philosophy for choosing what material to present in this set of lectures. As I say, there are these set of notes that give you a fairly good overview of the entire field. So I'm not going to try to rush and be comprehensive. Instead, my plan is to take it rather slowly and try to do some basic things, like the Unruh effect, in great detail to give you as good of, to help develop your physical intuition as much as possible, so that you're then ready to go and read more comprehensive treatises. You can just flip through the results, and it'll all make sense. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, well, let's get started. Of course, you all know about quantum field theory in flat space. But as I, yes? Is there a question? My notes are not on the web. I may put them there, or I may not. We'll see. I have notes, but they require a bit of cleaning up before I put them on the web. We'll see. OK. You all know about quantum field theory in flat space. But as I say, you've probably been taught to think about quantum field theory in flat space using a lot of the structure of the Poincaré group. For example, if you open a Weinberg's field theory textbook and you look up the definition of the word, say, particle, Weinberg says a particle is a unitary representation of the Poincaré group. Aha! So everything you've done for quantum field theory that relies heavily on your standard notion of particle is heavily based on the Poincaré group and therefore flat space. Now, what I want to do is teach you how to understand quantum field theory in a way that you can use in curved space-time. But I'm not sure how comfortable everyone is at, in terms of thinking about general curved spaces right now. So in fact, during most of my lectures, I'm going to simply present once again quantum field theory at a simple level in flat space. But I'm going to do it in a different language, not using the Poincaré group, for example, such that it readily generalizes the quantum field theory in curved space-time. All right. And then I will simply write down the corresponding formulas for quantum field theory in curved space-time, and you'll believe me, or else you can work through the details again on one of the homework assignments on the web. Okay. Well, here we go. So let's look at quantum field. Let's retell the story of quantum field theory from the beginning. Pretend you're a brand new student, just learning for the first time. But we're going to do this without heavily using the Poincaré group. So quantum field theory. And where are we going to start? Well, of course, we're going to start with the simplest case. We're going to start with a free scalar field. And in fact, that's all that I'm going to discuss explicitly in these lectures today. Of course, one can handle much more complicated interacting theories and so forth in curved space-time. There's various technology one has to develop to do that. But the long and short of it is that once you understand how free scalar fields work, there's not much conceptually new in understanding how the interacting fields work. There's the same story about renormalization and so forth that you find in flat space. So let's just look at the free scalar field and try to understand that in detail over the next couple of days. So we'll start with an action. Action is minus 1/2. Work in d dimensions. And I'll write this down in a general curved space. And let's make it free but massive. All right. Is this big enough for folks in the back to see? Is that the right scale? OK, good. All right. There's the action. From the action, of course, we get the equation of motion, which is the D'Alembertian in curved space minus m squared on phi is equal to 0. All right. Now, the first thing we want to do when presented with an equation of motion is actually what you did in the case of your original quantum field theory course. The first thing you did when you learned about this in flat space was you solved this equation in general. You wrote down the general solution using Fourier decomposition, which used the translation symmetry of flat space. And that gave you a general expression where the arbitrary coefficients turned into creation annihilation operators. Well, we want to solve this equation in general, but in the way that we can set it in curved space. In curved space, of course, we don't have, in general, Fourier transforms. But there's another way, there's another useful way to solve this equation. So we're going to solve it, solve using Green's functions. Okay. Green's functions, of course, are simple concepts. You all know what they are. The particular Green's functions are things that satisfy the equation of motion. They have two arguments. Satisfy the equation of motion, but with a source, which I'm going to choose to be minus delta of xy. All right. I'm interested in two Green's functions, two particular Green's functions, which are, I'll call g plus and g minus, the advanced and retarded Green's function. So remember what these are. If this is a point x in Minkowski space, I always work in Minkowski signature, 3 plus 1, say. This is a point x in Minkowski space, and we look at the future light cone and the past light cone. Oh, it's OK. You know what I'm going to write there, future and past. The important thing, which I'll write large, is that the advanced Green's function, g plus, that's a plus, of xy, is the Green's function which vanishes when, what's my convention right here? It vanishes when x is, that symbol there is the greater than symbol, but it means when x is in the future of y. Okay. So the advanced Green's function is something that you, where you impose the boundary condition 0 in the future, you evolve backwards, you hit this source here, oh, I guess I should think of the source as being at the point y, and then when x becomes in the past of y, it can be non-zero. Similarly, the retarded Green's function is 0 when y is in the future of x. And those are the two Green's functions which I'll be most interested in. OK. Question? Yes? I was just going to mention that. So, in fact, during much of these lectures on the blackboard, I'm going to use notation appropriate for flat space so I don't confuse the non-experts on curved space. I will at some point write down the generalizations to curved space. All of the correct equations in curved space are on the web on the homework assignment. Okay? But I'll mention the important things. So what is this delta function? It turns out when you work in curved space, you have to worry about what exactly this means, as there are various possible generalizations of the flat space delta function. The one that I'm interested in is the biscalar delta function, the one that is indeed a scalar in both of its arguments. So what that means is that if I take it and integrate it over a curved manifold, so I would like to say that the integral of some function times delta of xy is the function evaluated at, say, y, if I integrate over x, okay? But you realize that, but I can't do it quite like this. If f is a scalar function and delta is a scalar function, then the integral dx over some curved manifold is not diffeomorphism invariant. So in fact, the correct formula in the Rent signature is the minus g there. So in particular, the distribution that I'm interested in curved spacetime is the so-called biscalar delta function. It's a scalar in both arguments. And that means that if you wish to use it as a distribution, you have to insert a square root of minus g by hand. That's nice because it means that my g remains a scalar even in curved spacetime. OK. If this looks like, if this is confusing to you, just ignore it. We're after the main physical intuition in these lectures, and you can go through in the homework and work out all the details. All right. So we're interested in those Green's functions. And an important point, which some of you may know and some of you may not, is that you can, in general, use these two Green's functions, the advanced and retarded Green's functions, to solve the equations of motion in terms of initial data. So you're probably used to using these Green's functions to find out the effect on the scalar field if I add some source. That's, of course, right from the definition. But there's a different idea, which is to say that, all right, I'm working in something that might be Minkowski space or might be any other dynamical system, say, a curved spacetime, in which the initial value problem is well posed. That is to say, I'm working in some context where I can draw some hypersurface that I'll call sigma in spacetime. For example, this might be a Cauchy surface. And then if I give initial data on sigma, say phi and phi dot, its time derivative, I want to be able to reconstruct the solution for phi of x at any point in the spacetime, right? That's our usual idea of the initial value problem in physics. So I think something that you may or may not be familiar with is that you can, in general, solve this initial value problem using those Green's functions. That is to say, there's a nifty relation which says that if I take phi and evaluate it at any point in the spacetime, this is equal to minus the integral over any surface which could be used as an initial value surface, say a Cauchy surface in a globally hyperbolic spacetime, or if you would rather just think about this in Minkowski space, any surface t equals constant. So what I'm going to do first is to write down this formula in Minkowski space for the case where this is a surface t equals constant. So I'll imagine there's some coordinate y0, which is constant on this surface. Okay. In that context, the formula is that we want to integrate, which makes sure my sign's right. Okay, so I was in d-dimensional space-time. This is a codimension 1 hypersurface, so I have d minus 1 integrals left to do. I'm in flat space, so I don't have to worry about any measure factors. In that case, the expression is that what I want to do is take the advanced Green's function minus the retarded Green's function evaluated at x and y, and I want to multiply it by the derivative with respect to y0 of phi of y, and then subtract from that the derivative with respect to y0, g plus minus g minus x y times phi of y, like so. Okay. So just so I get an idea of how much I should say about this, please raise your hand if this formula is familiar. Okay, good. That's what I thought. So I should say a lot about it. That's fine. Okay, so by the way, deriving this result and its curve space generalization are mostly what you do if you complete homework assignment number 1 that I posted on the web. So the only complete derivation I know of this, or the one that I can think of when I was putting together these lectures, is too long for me to actually give here in real time, but I've stepped you through it in the homework assignments. But let me motivate this expression a bit, okay? So the thing that features here is the difference between the advanced and retarded Green's functions, right? Now, recall that, well, both the advanced and retarded Green's functions are Green's functions. If I act on them with the equation of motion, I get a delta function. So if I take the equation of motion and act on the difference, g plus minus g minus, what do I get? Well, I get a delta function from g plus, and I get a delta function with the opposite sign from g minus, so I get 0. So the important thing to remember is that g plus minus g minus is a solution to the equations of motion. Okay? It's a particular, very interesting solution. So that's good, because it says that if I would act on this expression here with the equation of motion, which is a linear operator, well, you see, if it acts on the argument x here, it acts on the argument x here, and so we've just seen that g plus minus g minus satisfies the equation of motion, and we give 0. Then we note that this wave operator commutes with a time derivative, as written, and as a result, if I act with it on this term, I also get 0. So it's clear that the right-hand side of what I've written down is a solution to the equations of motion, which is good. So is the left side. All right. So if these are both solutions to the equations of motion, to verify that they're equal, all we have to do is verify that they have the same initial data. In other words, they take the same values on some surface, like, say, the surface sigma. Okay. But it turns out that's not so hard. To see that, let's ask, what is g plus of xy minus g minus of x, y if we evaluate this entire thing on the surface sigma. Okay. So, oh, I see. I forgot to write down something important, but that's okay. We'll get there. The right way to think about this is to realize that the advanced and retarded Green's functions are not really all that different creatures, right? Their definitions were very similar over here. All that was different were the boundary conditions. Okay. And in fact, in flat space, we can give a quick argument that the advanced Green's function at x and y is in fact equal to the retarded Green's function if I simply interchange the two arguments, y and x. Now, how does that argument go, very quickly? Well, suppose I'm working in flat space, which is the context I want to give you the details. In flat space, we have translation invariants. So in flat space, we know that any Green's function is a function only of x minus y. It doesn't care about x and y separately. It only cares about x minus y. Right? So if it only cares about x minus y, that means that if it's a Green's function, when I apply this differential operator to the first argument, well, it actually satisfies the same equation in the second argument, because taking a derivative with respect to x is the same as taking a derivative with respect to y. Right? Maybe with a minus sign. But this is a second order operator, so the minus sign goes away. So what we see then is that this expression, the retarded Green's function evaluated at y and then x, satisfies the equation for a Green's function in both arguments. And if I switch y and x, then that interchanges the condition that it vanishes for y greater than x with the condition that it vanishes for x greater than y. Right? So what we see is that, in fact, there is just a symmetry in flat space that quickly relates the advanced Green's function to the retarded Green's function. And it's just this symmetry. Is that clear? OK, good. Now, the interesting point is that this is, in fact, true in general. This relationship also holds in curved spacetime. All right? But again, to derive it in curved spacetime carefully takes a little more time than I wish to use, well, a fair amount more time than I wish to use in this lecture. So I put that on the homework assignment, too. Okay? But I hope you believe me that this relationship holds in general in curved spacetime. Well, so if it does, then what happens if we go to some constant time surface and subtract the two Green's functions? Ah. OK. Well, if we're on a constant time surface, meaning that the point x is on this surface and the point y is on this surface, then, well, again, I'll give you an argument that holds in Minkowski space. But with some more work on your homework assignment, you can show that the result holds in general. In Minkowski space, there is a symmetry that interchanges x and y. It's just a rotational symmetry, right? So as long as both x and y are space-like separated on sigma, g minus of xy is the same as g minus of yx. But I just argued in Minkowski space that g minus of yx is the same as g plus of xy, so this difference is 0. Right? OK. Good. Now, you might wonder how this is helping. It's helping because if I now go and evaluate this expression on the hypersurface sigma, so I have both x and y on sigma, I've just argued that this term doesn't contribute. All that's left is this term. And of course, what I want to get when I evaluate this expression with x and y both on sigma is just an identity. I want to show that the right-hand side has a value at y on sigma, which is just phi at that point. So you see now that since the first term is 0, I'll get the answer I want. I'll get just phi of x if this bit here, the derivative of g plus minus g minus, is a delta function. Right? OK. So my next claim, which I'll write here in the corner, is that indeed, the derivative with respect to y0 of g plus minus g minus is a delta function. You can't read that, but you know what it should say. It's a delta function. All right. Once again, to give a complete proof of that would take some time. It's on the homework assignment. But I hope this seems like a plausible result. Why should it be plausible? Well, again, we're evaluating these Green's functions with two points, both arguments x and y, on the same constant time surface sigma, right? So if the two points are, in fact, not coincident, if they're separated at all, then, well, they're space-like separated. And so, in fact, we know that having imposed either advanced or retarded boundary conditions, the advanced retarded Green's functions vanish at all space-like separated points, right? They vanish. It vanishes unless one point is in the future of the other. So it's clear that this expression, whatever it is some sort of distribution supported at coincident points. Okay. Well, oops. The most natural distribution to appear is the delta function, and that's the right answer. Again, you can go through and do the calculation for yourself on the homework assignment. But the homework assignment, by the way, doesn't just say prove that this is the case. It steps you through the argument. It's all there. All right. So what we conclude is that we've checked that indeed the right-hand side of this expression. I guess I need some place to write this. Time to start again. We've checked that indeed the right-hand side of our expression, when evaluated when we choose x in sigma, is just phi of x. So we've checked that this has half of the right initial data. Yes, question? We've checked so far half of the initial data. We checked that we get the right value for phi. Of course, the full initial data for the Cauchy problem that we have to double check is to check the time derivative of the right-hand side. Right? OK, good. So what happens if we do that? Well, if we take the time derivative of the first term, now we have the derivative of the difference of the Green's functions, which we just said was a delta function. OK, so assuming we got all the signs right and so forth, we get the derivative of phi. All right. On the other hand, if we take the derivative of the second term, we get the second derivative of the Green's function. Okay. We get the second derivative of the difference of the Green's function, but the difference of the Green's function satisfies the equation of motion. Here it is. So I can turn the second time derivative into second space derivatives, and then integrate by parts and get rid of them. Okay. So that's a short version of the argument. So in fact, what we find is that this is phi dot of x. Good. All right. So we've checked all this modulo some minus signs that I think are correct, but that I'll let you check in detail on the homework. Yes? Yes. Equals 0, yeah. Yeah. Where? Yes. No, it's all a little subtle. When you take the next derivative with respect to y0, yes, you get a delta. Oh, sorry. Actually, I realized I didn't explain something here. This is the answer just like over here when I evaluate the two arguments on the same constant time surface sigma. And what I mean by the right-hand side is it's a delta function on the surface sigma. That is to say, it's a d minus one dimensional delta function. Okay, perhaps that explains the answer to your question. Yes, good. Sorry. That's very important, indeed. Because I wanted to give me one when I integrated over just this much, this hypersurface, and not over the entire space-time. So, sorry, I forgot that important point. Okay. The Green's functions have two arguments, x and y. Okay? So, certainly there are various possible cases, if you like. The x and y might be time-like related, they might be space-like related. You can expect different behavior in those two cases. Also notice that this derivative has a special relationship to sigma, which I'll actually write down more carefully when I give you the curve space version of this in a moment. This derivative is the derivative in the direction which is orthogonal to sigma. Okay, so that's a key relationship here. Let me say it this way. In general, curve space, the Green's functions, of course, are supported in, let's take the retarded Green's function. In a general curve space, it's non-zero inside the entire future light cone, right? So suppose that I had chosen two points that were not on some constant time surface sigma, but were instead time-like related. Then there's no reason why this object should look anything like a delta function. Yes? Yeah. So the Green's functions don't depend on the hypersurface. The Green's functions are simply the Green's functions. But this is a statement about the difference of the Green's functions when both points are evaluated on the same hypersurface. Okay. Which is sort of a fancy way of saying that if you evaluate them at space-like separation and you consider similar space-like separations, you get this delta function. Okay. Other questions before going on? All right. Well, so I hope I've at least motivated that some expression like this is true. Let me take the time to write down the correct expression in a general curve space, and also to introduce a tiny bit of notation. So this kind of operation, where you take one function times the sort of time derivative of the other, and you subtract the time derivative of the first function times the second function, comes up a lot in the study of, hyperbolic equations in curve space, hyperbolic equations in general, and in the subject of quantum field theory in curved space-time. So it's useful to introduce a bit of notation to encapsulate that. So given two solutions to the equations of motion, which I'll call F and G, let's define an operation that I'm going to call F. This notation is not particularly standard. It's my own, but I find it very useful, as you'll see in a few moments. Let's define F circle G, this is just a funny product of functions, to be the integral over an arbitrary initial value surface sigma. So now I'm going to move to curve space time. Sigma might not be constant time in any obvious sense, but it should be some kind of space-like hypersurface that can be used for the initial value problem. There's an odd conventional minus I, which I'm going to add. And then we have the integral over the hypersurface. In general, we need a metric factor. And what is this? Well, H sigma is the induced metric on sigma. And then a funny expression, which I'll write this way, F n dot grad G, and I'll put two little arrows over the grad. And what does this mean? Well, as mentioned before, the important relationship between this derivative and this hypersurface, which was obvious in this special case, is that the derivative is in a direction orthogonal to the hypersurface. Well, that's what we want in general. So this is a derivative along some direction in space. And n is going to be the normal, the unit normal, future pointing vector where by normal I mean normal to sigma. Right? Sigma is in general a space-like surface. It has two normals, one that points toward the future and one that points toward the past. So let's choose the future pointing one. And what does this funny symbol mean? Well, f n dot grad g is defined to be f n dot grad g minus n dot grad f times g. So exactly the kind of combination we saw over here. But because I'm going to write it several times, it's useful to package it up in a fancy notation like this. So this double arrow just tells you that the derivative gets to act in both directions, and one way it picks up a minus sign. Okay? All right. So we define this expression for two solutions, and this is known as the Klein-Gordon inner product up to various choices of z2s. That is, sometimes people define this thing without this I, and sometimes people, when they define what they really call the Klein-Gordon inner product, like the complex conjugate, one of the two functions. But for our purposes, we will use this object. Yes? My next statement exactly, an excellent question. So here we have chosen a particular choice of trapezoidal sigma. In general, this thing does not depend on the choice of sigma. So how can we see that? Well, if you believe my motivation over here, you've seen one example of that. This, after all, is the Klein-Gordon inner product between phi and this solution, g plus minus g minus. Okay? We've argued that this gives phi of x for any constant time surface sigma. So we've already argued that this expression is, to a certain extent, at least for this special case, independent of the surface. Okay? It turns out it's independent in general. And how do you see that it's independent in general? Well, you can look at the Klein-Gordon current, which is f dA g minus g dA f. And one can show, as a consequence of the equation of motion, that this current is conserved. That is to say, in a general curved spacetime, this thing satisfies the local conservation law. Okay. Let's go ahead and do that calculation for flat space, and you'll believe the answer for curved space. So let's take. So now let's go to flat space, Minkowski space, and take the divergence of this current. Well, what do I get? I get a term which looks like d. dAf dAg. I get a term which looks like f dA dAg. I get a term which looks like dAg dAf when the derivative hits here. And if this derivative hits on this function a second time, I get g dA dAf. Looking at the blackboard, you see I have two terms that involve two first derivatives. They appear with opposite signs, so these cancel. On the other hand, in the remaining two terms, I have the wave operator. Now, in the one case, the wave operator acts on g. In the other case, it acts on f. But this was the important point about choosing to define this for two solutions of our wave equation. So since these both f and g satisfy the wave equation, I can replace this expression with m squared, and this one with m squared. And then I can cancel those two terms and get 0. Okay. So the associated current is conserved. And as a result, this expression is independent of hypersurface. Very good. Ah, yes, time is moving right along, isn't it? All right. So let's just summarize what we've learned so far in this more condensed notation. what we've done is to use the advanced and retarded Green's functions to construct a particularly interesting solution to the equation of motion, I think sometimes called the fundamental solution to the equation of motion. So what we have, if you like, we've defined some particular solution, which I will call g twiddle of xy, which is just the advanced Green's function minus the retarded. And we've seen that there is an identity which allows us to express an arbitrary solution to the equation of motion in terms of this Klein-Gordon inner product over any surface. And in the new notation, this is minus I g tilde circle, oops, that's right, phi. Okay. Actually, we can do something else as well. Recall that there is a relationship between g plus and g minus, given by just interchanging the arguments. G plus of xy is equal to g minus of yx. So what that tells us is that this fundamental solution is antisymmetric. Okay. So here, let's be careful here, g tilde is a function of two arguments. So when I write this expression this way, what I mean is that if the circle stands on the right-hand side of g, we're going to take the Klein-Gordon product on the second argument. That is, we'll kind of treat g like a matrix. So if I act on it on the right, it uses the second argument. Okay. But g was antisymmetric, so I could just as well have done the Klein-Gordon inner product on the left. So I can also write an identity like this that looks like minus I phi circle g tilde. Okay. Now let me point out one subtlety. This is the correct sign. It works the same way in both directions. Why is that? Well, I got here by arguing that taking the inner product on the first argument, I got here by arguing that g tilde is antisymmetric. So that means taking the inner product on the second argument is the same as taking the inner product on the first argument up to 1 minus sign, right? But the Klein-Gordon inner product itself is antisymmetric because of that minus sign. So when I switch this from the second to the first argument, I get 1 sign. And when I move phi to the left side of g, I get another minus sign. So they cancel. Okay. So we have this identity in general, which is very useful. All right. Very good. OK, I'm going to leave that up and erase the rest of the board for my next calculation. But I should see if there are any questions so far. And I know we've done no quantum field theory, merely classical theory of linear hyperbolic equations with Green's functions. But we are about to do something quantum. Further questions? No? All right. So we're going to treat this quantum the theory of this linear quantum field much as you would quantum mechanics for some interesting system like angular momentum. In that case, the first thing you want to understand is the algebra of operators. And then you can think about representations. So we're going to use this story to compute in a simple way the algebra of operators. What I want to do is calculate the commutator of phi at any point in spacetime with phi at any other point in the spacetime. Okay? Now, how am I going to do this? Well, again, I will actually do the calculation in class in the Minkowski space case. But a similar calculation works in general. In Minkowski space, the way that you're used to defining the commutation relations is in terms of the canonical commutation relations, which refer to commutation relations on at some time or at some on some spatial slice, some hypersurface sigma. And so in fact, the commutation relations that you know are that a field operator at some point x in space at some time t with a field operator at a different point y in space, but at the same time t is 0. And similarly for the velocities, equals 0. But that if I commute a field operator with a velocity, phi dot, at the same time, then assuming that I have a canonically normalized field, canonical normalization, this is just commuting a field with its conjugate momentum, and therefore I get a delta function. And I have to make sure I get the sign right. I believe it's this one, I times delta x minus y. And what I mean by this is, again, a delta function on the space-like surface sigma. This is a delta function that in order to get 1, I need only integrate it across this constant time slice. Oh, and for in curved space, written in this way, this is, again, the bi-scalar delta function, because phi is a scalar along the slice. It has no spatial indices. And phi dot is also a scalar in terms of diffeomorphisms on the slice sigma. It has no spatial indices. Okay. Okay. Is there a question? No. So I wish to simply do this calculation in general using what we know over there. And it's fairly straightforward. What I want to do is to use this identity here. Realize that phi, of course, is a quantum field. It's an operator. But the Green's function is just a C number. And everything in the Klein-Gordon inner product is just a C number. So those all commute with everything. So I can therefore use this identity. I'm going to use it twice to write this as minus I squared times the commutator of G circle phi evaluated at the point x. So again, all I've done is said that phi of x is equal to minus I times G circle phi. And then over here, I'm going to write this as phi circle G at y. Okay. And it's convenient to use the two identities in the different orders. What's that? It's a question? Oh, yeah, yeah. G tilde. Thank you. Okay. Good. So what I'd like to do now is simply expand out this rather condensed notation and remind you that this what this is. So this is the integral over the surface sigma. And there's, let's see, we'll integrate some coordinate z. There's some factors of a metric. But the most important thing is that this is g tilde of, let's see, the way I've written it here, the x goes first. We're integrating over this z, and I'm calling it z1 because there's going to be a z2. Phi dot of z1. Minus, oh, and I apologize that I'm again going to do this calculation. Oh, hell, I'll just erase this thing here. I'm going to do the calculation in detail only in Minkowski space, so I can write less symbols and it moves a little bit faster. You can do the calculation for yourself in curved space, and everything works out just the same. So then we'll subtract g tilde dot xy, xz1, phi of z1. OK. And then we're going to take the commutator with the integral, also over sigma, dz2 g tilde of, I'm going to do this one the other way, phi with g tilde. So that means that I write phi of z2, good, times g tilde dot of z2y minus phi of phi dot of z2 times g tilde of z2y. OK, good. And I need to put a big parenthesis here to close that off, and in the commutator. OK, great. So a long expression, but a calculation we can now do. Why can we do this? Because all of the field operators that appear in either integral are on the surface sigma. And it's the same surface sigma. So I can now easily calculate I know what the commutator is of this phi dot of z1 with this phi of z2, because they're on the same surface sigma. It's given just by that expression over there. So of course, what I see is that this phi dot commutes with that phi dot, this phi commutes with this phi, and all I get are the cross terms. And the cross terms just give me delta functions that allow me to do one of these integrals. So in the end, what I have left is just the integral over one copy of sigma of some dz of, what is this here? It's just g tilde of xz, g tilde dot of zy, minus g tilde dot of xz, z, g tilde of zy. OK, great. Also known as, what happened to, let's see, did I lose all my, yes, that's right. These minus i's went away when I replaced them with these expressions, because after all, we defined the minus I here exactly to make these things real. So there are no i's floating around yet, except that the commutator of phi with phi dot gives us an I. And so somewhere here, there is an I. And in fact, it's a minus I because the way I've written it here, with the xz function undifferentiated, it comes from this phi dot it comes from xz of phi dot with this guy, and phi dot with phi is actually minus I. Good, OK. So this is minus I times this expression, which is nothing other than g tilde circle g tilde, right? And now we can use our identity here, g tilde being a solution of the equation of motion, to tell us that this is, in fact, the commutator of phi of x with phi of y. And it's time for me to upgrade the new chalk. Is exactly, and getting all the factors of minus I correct, I times g tilde of xy. In other words, the commutator is, in general, the difference between the advanced Green's function and the retarded Green's function, like so. OK, great. And this is a lovely covariant expression that does not require the choice of any particular hypersurface, which turns out to hold for any linear field theory satisfying the usual wave equation in any spacetime. Great. So now we know what our algebra is. What we'd like to do is to express them in a somewhat more familiar form. Okay. Again, if you were following the usual first course of quantum field theory in flat space, what you'd really want is not just the operator algebra of fields, but you want an algebra associated with creation annihilation operators. Okay. So where do those come from? Well, so just as a brief motivation, recall that in Minkowski space, what you end up doing is you take the field operator and you expand it as a sum of creation operators times various functions and also annihilation operators. So, okay. And the observation that I want to make is that you can pick out these coefficients out of the general solution by taking an appropriate inner product between these mode functions here and the solution itself. That is to say, suppose that I compute the following expression in flat space. If I compute something like e to the minus I omega t Klein-Gordon inner product with the field operator. Well, oh, sorry. I need to write down the full mode here, e to the I kx e to the minus I omega t with the field operator. This is a solution to the equation of motion if omega is the right function of k. If I compute this inner product, then you see what happens is that the Klein-Gordon inner product involves these integrals over a spatial slice, right? So when I do that integral over a spatial slice, and I multiply this function times this expansion, it'll pick off the relevant Fourier mode, right? And it gives me something which is either a creation operator or an annihilation operator. And of course, good. It has to give me something which is independent of t, because we've argued that this is independent of the surface in which you evaluate it. So it has to give me, let's see, it has to be the case that if I do this right, I get this e to the I omega t to cancel the e to the I omega t here. And so this is just going to give me maybe some normalization coefficient, some number, times the annihilation operator. Okay. So the story is that we want to think about the same process in general. Let me erase this for a moment. That was just motivation. Okay. And instead, let's consider any solution that I'll call u of x to the equation of motion. Any solution you like. Okay. Well, in that case, let me define an operator which will be the analog of either a creation or an annihilation operator, though I don't yet know which one. The operator is A sub u. I want to define this to be just the Klein-Gordon inner product of u with phi. Okay, that's some expression we can write down along these lines. It's an integral over an arbitrary hypersurface of u phi dot minus phi u dot. And what I'd like to do is to calculate the commutator of two such creatures. So let's take the commutator of AU with AU prime. Well, this is not difficult to do. We just apply the definition. And I'll do it this way. So AU is u with phi. AU prime is u prime with phi prime. But it turns out to be convenient to write it as phi with u prime. So since I switched the order of these things in the definition, I need a minus sign. OK. So why is that convenient? Because then the notation helps me. I can pull these Klein-Gordon operations outside of the commutators, because that's all C number stuff. And everything is organized. All right. And I know what this is. This is exactly this fundamental solution g tilde. Right? And now we have all these nice identities that if I take the Klein-Gordon inner product of g tilde with an arbitrary solution u to the equations of motion, or u prime, what I get is, well, I've written it the other way. I guess what I want, rewriting this as g on phi is equal to I phi, I see that this is nothing other than minus I u on u prime. No. I forgot that I. The commutator of phi with phi is I times g tilde. So when I take that I and multiply it by my minus I get u on u prime. What did I do wrong? Oh, okay. Well, one of the exercises in the homework is to double check all the minus signs, but this looks good so far. Okay. Great. So what we see is that the commutator is given by just the Klein-Gordon inner product of the two solutions, right? Good. So a minus sign has changed relative to my notes, and I see where I dropped it. But when I wrote my notes, I thought I carefully checked that I got the right final sign. So I therefore suspect that there is some other minus sign in the discussion that we may or may not have caught, or that we may or may not catch in the next few steps. This looks correct so far. But somewhere in the story, there's a minus sign, possibly in stuff we haven't gotten to yet. What's that? This one? No, that minus is correct. That minus is because I reversed the order over here and wrote AU prime as phi with U prime instead of U prime with phi. Okay. Ah, where did the minus sign go? Okay. Phi with phi, commutator of phi with phi is I times G tilde. Yeah? Okay. And now I times G tilde with U prime is, so phi is minus I G tilde with phi. So therefore, G tilde with phi is I times phi. And indeed, if I take I G tilde with U prime, I should get minus 1, which cancels that minus sign. Okay. This is not worth our time to do now. Minus signs we can all catch later when we have lots and lots of time. This may be right. As I said, I may have dropped another minus sign someplace later that we will also catch. OK. So let's consider an interesting case. Suppose, in particular, that we take U prime to be the complex conjugate of U. OK? If we do so, actually, I should have mentioned something already. Since this Klein-Gordon product is anti-symmetric, it's therefore clear that if I take AU, commutator with AU, that simply vanishes. Right? Good. So let's take the next most interesting case. Let's take U prime to be the complex conjugate of U. All right? Now, various things can happen. The Klein-Gordon inner product, remember, involves this funny minus sign here that keeps appearing. So what that means is the Klein-Gordon inner product is not anything like positive definite. Actually, it's got an I in it, so it's complex. So I'm eventually going to be interested in calculating the Klein-Gordon inner product of U with its complex conjugate. Now, that might be positive, it might be negative, or it might be zero in general. Okay. The most familiar case to consider is when this is non-zero. So let's simply choose this to be non-zero. Okay. Now, as explained in the homework assignment, you may always choose a basis of solutions in which these inner products are non-zero. So we can think of this as being a fairly general statement. Suppose it's non-zero. And in fact, let's suppose, now here's the tricky sign. Let's suppose that, in fact, U with U star is greater than, less than zero. OK? Now, again, that's not really much of a supposition, because since the Klein-Gordon product is anti-symmetric, if you happen to have chosen a U and a U star where the product was greater than zero, you can arrive at my case just by reversing what you call U and U star. Straightforward operation, right? So this is still a general case. And then, well, we may as well normalize these things. May as well just divide out by some constant to set this to be some convenient number. So in fact, let us suppose that, in fact, U with U star is minus 1. OK? Well, let's then notice the following. I'm going to need a little bit more space in the chalkboard. See, what I'd really like to compute to see to what extent these things act like creation annihilation operators is I'd like to compute something about the Hermitian conjugate of the operator AU. Well, what is the Hermitian conjugate of the operator AU? Well, it's the Hermitian conjugate of the Klein-Gordon inner product of u with phi, right? So the Hermitian conjugation acts on phi in a simple way. It's, oh, did I mention that we're considering a real scalar field? It was, in fact, obvious when I wrote down the commutation relations, because those are only correct for a real scalar field. Otherwise, there are complex things that come in. But I intend to be, we are considering here a real scalar field. Therefore, the adjoint of phi is simply phi. When the Hermitian conjugation acts on u, of course, it gives us a u star. But there's one more bit. You'll recall that in my particular definition of this circle operation, there is a conventional factor of minus I. So when the Hermitian conjugation acts on this little circle thing, it gives me a minus sign. OK. But nevertheless, up to this minus sign, we see that the adjoint of AU is nothing other than A, up to the minus sign, it's nothing other than AU star. So that means that we can quickly compute the commutator of AU with the adjoint of AU. And the answer is, help me out here, the answer is that this is simply the commutator of AU with minus AU star. And so I get a minus sign here, and this gives me minus u on u star. And we chose to consider u and u star such that this Klein-Gordon inner product was minus 1. So the answer is 1. And we see that, in fact, these guys have the usual algebra for the creation and annihilation operators, because, of course, if I compute a dagger u with a dagger u, I get 0. Oops. All right. Good. So this is where the creation and annihilation operators lie within this story. Now, here's the fun part, though. The fun part is that we arrived at this kind of conclusion choosing a fairly general type of solution to the wave equation. There's no requirement this be a Fourier mode or anything simple like that kind of in Minkowski space. It could be any solution to the wave equation which has the property that its Klein-Gordon inner product with its complex conjugate is minus 1. Okay, and there are rather a lot of such creatures, as we'll be talking about more. We'll be giving an example probably tomorrow. Okay. Yes? So far, I've only showed you one particular mode, right? The next step is, as you say, to do this for a basis of solutions, okay? So let's just mention that give me a little space to write. Exactly what we want to do next. OK. This is something we can compute for any two solutions to the wave equation, right? And you see that what we get is something, well, it's something which is the Klein-Gordon inner product. Well, what's that? Well, it's some antisymmetric function of the inputs, u and u prime. OK? Solutions to a linear equation are some big, huge vector space, right? So this is an antisymmetric matrix, if you like, given one element of the vector space and another element of the vector space, I get some number. Well, it's an antisymmetric tensor. Okay. So what do we like to do with antisymmetric tensors? Well, one of the nice things is if you had a symmetric tensor, you would diagonalize it. With an antisymmetric tensor, it's nice to do something a little bit different. Schematically, what you like to do is write them in a sort of block diagonal form where they look like this. This is called the Jordan normal form of an antisymmetric matrix. Uh-huh. And so in general, what you can do And I will save the proof again for the homework. But in general, it's possible to one can always choose a basis in the space of solutions of the form, let's call them U in, for positive and negative integers z. Well, let's not worry about it. Let's take n not 0. Okay. Such that the negative guys, u minus n, is the complex conjugate of the positive ones. Okay. Such a basis can be found. And such that the Klein-Gordon inner product takes this block diagonal form. That is to say that un on um is equal to a Kronecker delta of n with minus m. And I think, what do I see? I want to write, oh, yes. And I want sine, sign, of n. In other words, it's positive if n is positive and negative when n is negative. Actually, is that the sign I want here? No, I want overall minus sign now. OK. All the other statement is also true. Okay. So as I say, a detailed proof is outlined in the homework. But it's the same idea as just saying that if I have an antisymmetric matrix in a general vector space, I can, by a general linear transformation, render it in block diagonal form with normalized values 1 and minus 1. It's the same idea. So such a basis exists, but in general, it's far from unique, again, as we will discuss with an example probably tomorrow. All right. So let's see. Good. Oh, and it's clear that if I have such a basis, then in fact what this gives me is a complete set of things that are like creation annihilation operators, right? Such that all the creation operators can meet with each other, all the annihilation operators can meet with each other, and a given creation operator with the corresponding annihilation operator gives me the right factor of 1 and minus 1. So I have all the structure you use to build the Fock space in usual quantum field theory. All right. So that's what we now want to do. We've now said as much as I want to say about the algebra for the field operators. So we've now constructed the analog of working with SU2 and finding raising and lowering operators, convenient ways to move around the algebra. What we now want to do is say something about building representations of this algebra. Okay? And of course, you know how to do this because we have all the structure of the Fock space. So given one of these bases, so let me call this basis capital U. Okay. I need more chalk. Given capital U, we can define a zero particle state, and I'll put this in quotes, which is often called the vacuum, so I'll write it with a big zero. And it's going to be defined by this particular choice of basis U. Well, how is it defined? It's defined by saying that it's annihilated by all the things that ought to be annihilation operators. That is, all the things right in this relation. How do you know which of these is the annihilation operator? Well, it's the one that, when you put it on the left in the commutator, gives you 1 as opposed to minus 1. If you swap the roles of A and A dagger, you'd get a minus 1 here. So assuming I've got my signs right, that says that we want this to be annihilated for n greater than 0. OK. Great. So here's a vacuum state, and then we can build an entire Fock space. What is the Fock space? Well, it's just the Hilbert space generated by acting on this thing with the various creation operators. U A1, U A K, for various values of K, and taking linear combinations and so forth. Okay, it's the usual story. All right. So now for the fun bit, though, we've defined, yes? Well, you notice I didn't actually write the word vacuum on the board. This is an excellent point to bring up here. Okay? What I've said is it's going to define a state and give us a representation. Okay? And it's something that is natural to call, in some sense, a zero particle state. Okay? Because it's annihilated by all the annihilation operators. Now, an important question is it in general a vacuum state of anything in terms of being the lowest eigenstate of a Hamiltonian? Aha. Well, let me preface my response by reminding you that if we work in a general curve spacetime, there is not going to be a time translation symmetry, and there's not going to be a Hamiltonian to be the ground state of. Okay. So that's just to say that in a general curve spacetime, the answer to that question is, well, the answer is no, because there's no Hamiltonian to be the ground state of. But the answer is not terribly important, because there is no such thing as it. Well, in a general curve spacetime, I couldn't possibly define a vacuum state as the ground state of some system. Okay. So this thing is conventionally called a vacuum state defined by this basis. But the point being made here is that you should be very careful when you interpret those words. It has some of the properties of a vacuum state that you're familiar with. It's annihilated by the annihilation operators. But it is not necessarily the lowest state of any Hamiltonian. Okay. Let me say it this way. If I was working in Minkowski space, it would be natural to choose my basis in such a way that they respect the symmetries of the spacetime. Okay? If I was working in Minkowski space, it would be natural to choose the basis functions such that, for example, they have a simple behavior under time translations. Okay? If the basis functions have a simple behavior under time translations, you might expect, and you would be correct, that they then have a simple behavior that the corresponding creation and annihilation operators have a simple behavior with respect to the Hamiltonian. Okay. So when a time translation symmetry exists, if you choose these mode functions to be eigenfunctions under time translation, that is to have e to the minus omega t time dependence, then you will find that if you commute an annihilation operator with the Hamiltonian, you get plus or minus omega, and that therefore, as a result, this thing will be the lowest state, the lowest energy state with respect to that Hamiltonian. So that was all to say that in general, this is not the lowest state of any Hamiltonian. If there is a well-defined Hamiltonian for the system, you can choose a that will pick out a particular basis, or particular subclass of bases, for which it turns out that this thing will be the vacuum state. Is that clear? Okay. But in general, it's important to realize that this thing is not a lowest energy state, and that in general, not only is the vacuum not a lowest energy state, but in general, there's no reason for the vacuum to be an energy eigenstate. In general, the vacuum in this sense may not be an eigenstate of any Hamiltonian operator which is around. Again, in a general curve spacetime, that wouldn't bother you because there's no Hamiltonian to work with in the first place. But it's an important thing to bear in mind. Okay. This will all become much more concrete tomorrow when we do an example. And we'll talk more about the Hamiltonians and so forth. Okay. Yes, question? One has the stress energy tensor and one can discuss it. Where what, sorry? So this, okay. there's a long story here, which I will tell part of. Okay. So in flat space, the Hamiltonian is really defined by the fact that it generates a time translation symmetry. It has an expression in terms of a stress energy tensor. That's true. The stress energy tensor is something that we can try to define in a general curve spacetime. There are challenges doing it in quantum field theory, but we can try. Now, it turns out that for the stress energy tensor itself, if you're thinking about the local stress energy tensor, that's a complicated object even for flat space. Okay. For example, it turns out in flat space that if you considered an arbitrary state and the expectation value of t mu nu, if you tried to consider the stress energy tensor at some one fixed point and ask for sort of the smallest possible expectation value of the stress energy tensor, it turns out that's not given by the vacuum. Right? In the vacuum, the stress energy tensor is zero. But actually, something I put on your homework assignment is to show that even in Minkowski space with the usual Fock space, there are two particle states, that is, a state with two particles in it, for which the expectation value of t mu nu is negative. Okay. So the stress energy tensor in its local form is not a terribly useful object in terms of trying to minimize its expectation value or its eigenvalues, if you like, to find a vacuum state. Now you could try to integrate t mu nu over some slice. But the thing is that the integral of t mu nu over some slice in a general curve spacetime depends on which slice you choose. In general relativity, t mu nu is only locally conserved. Okay. If you integrate its value over a slice, it's typically not globally conserved. If you ask when is it globally conserved, when is there a global conserved quantity you can construct from t mu nu, the answer is only when there's a symmetry in the spacetime, an isometry. Okay, so we're back to the same story. Yes. This point will also come up again tomorrow or Friday in a somewhat more tangible form, that the stress energy tensor itself does funny things. Okay. But in the last few minutes, what do I want to do? Well, having now discussed the important physical reasons why in a general curve spacetime, we do not have a structure that allows us to pick out one such basis over another, we should ask the question of, well, since there are, I claim, and I will show you tomorrow in detail, multiple choices for this kind of basis, I could choose it in various possible ways, we should ask the question, how are the various choices related? Okay? So suppose you make one choice, you pick out a basis U. So we'll compare the choice for a basis U with some other basis also satisfying this property, which I will call V. We want to know how do the answers differ, right? This is just like if you were constructing representations of any other algebra. You might first start by constructing various representations and then asking which representations were equivalent, which ones are isomorphic, which ones are unitarily equivalent, right? So let's ask this question. And it turns out it's not so hard. So here I just imagine that I have some similar basis V, which I'll write as, in terms of functions, V sub n. And I'll try very hard to make my U's distinct from my V's. Tell me if I fail. So the important point is that since both of these are bases, it's clear that if we take any function in the V basis, I can expand it in terms of functions in the U basis. So let's do so. Sum over, I'll call them M. And it's convenient to separate the U's from the U stars, that is the what I called over here the n greater than 0 elements of the basis from the n less than 0 elements of the basis. And we just need some coefficients. And I'm going to call them alpha in M and minus beta in M. Okay. So there is some relation like this between the modes, just whatever the coefficients are. Of course, if we wanted to, we could express these coefficients in terms of the Klein-Gordon inner product of the mode on the left, the V mode, with the U-modes. Because if I take the Klein-Gordon inner product of the right-hand side with a U-mode, it just picks off the appropriate beta or alpha. OK, we have a relation of this kind. And this means that we have a similar relation for the creation and annihilation operators. In particular, A, V, N is just Vn with phi, which is the sum over m greater than 0 of alpha n m a u n minus beta n m. And what goes here? A plus a dagger U m. Okay, great. So sort of the obvious thing, this sign changed because instead of writing a sub u m star, I wrote a dagger u m. And if you recall, although it's no longer on the board, a dagger u m is exactly minus a u m star. But anyway, there's a relationship between the various creation annihilation operators as well. So what does this mean for the various, quote, vacuum states? The vacuum associated with a V basis is defined by the condition that it's annihilated. This is a V, OK? That it's annihilated for n greater than 0. Right? That's its definition. So, but I know how to write a v in terms of the a u's. So let me just do that. So this is the statement that the sum over m greater than 0, alpha n m a u m plus beta n m a dagger u m acting on 0, b is 0, right? So this is an equation that we can solve in detail. And I will write down the solution in a minute. But let's see, Rob said I can have an extra 5 minutes. So I'll just mention an observation here, and this would be a good place to end. One of the things we can conclude immediately is that the two vacuum states are different. Now, how can we see that? Well, suppose for a moment we thought they were the same. Suppose that I tried to put the U vacuum state here and see what happens. Well, the U vacuum state is indeed annihilated by the annihilation operators. But then this combination of creation operators would come along and act on it, give me something non-zero. So if I put the U vacuum into this equation, it would not give me 0, and therefore is not equal to the V vacuum, right? OK. So what we see is that choosing a different basis of modes, I should write this down, these two differ if beta is non-zero, right? If beta is 0, then they could be the same. If beta is 0, then if I put the U vacuum in here, I get the right answer. The annihilation operators annihilate it. And if there's no betas, I get 0. OK? So sometimes these things are the same state, and sometimes they're not, depending on whether this mode transformation mixes creation and annihilation operators. Good. All right. It turns out that one can solve this equation in general to express the U vacuum in terms of the V vacuum. The way to do that, I'll just write this over here, is that, as you know, due to the commutation relations, was there a question? Okay. Due to the commutation relations, a dagger is sort of like taking a derivative with respect to a. Right? That's the way they work in the commutation relations. If you think that way, you can kind of view this as a differential equation for the V vacuum. Here's a derivative with respect to UA, to AU. And here's an AU. So it's a linear equation. The answer is going to be some kind of exponential because the derivative gives me something proportional to the state. Anyway, it turns out the answer is, and I encourage you to verify this in detail, that the U vacuum can be written as some normalization constant times the exponential of minus 1/2 sum over n and m of alpha inverse. This means take alpha and view it as a matrix, and take its matrix inverse, times beta n m a dagger n a dagger m, all acting on the original. Oops, which one's which? It's important. I see every. Yeah, okay. That must be right, because what I meant here is un and um. There we go. All right. So the two states are not the same, but one can in general solve for one in terms of the other. So at least formally they are related. Okay. Now I say formally because there's a question of what's this normalization constant n. If you solve for it, the answer is that it's something you might write as the norm of alpha to the 1/4, by which I mean the sum over n and m of alpha adjoint in the matrix sense with alpha. Oh, actually, let's do it this way. Complex conjugate of alpha n m alpha n m to the, oops, sorry, that should be 1/2, and that's minus 1/4. OK. Oh. No. Beta. See, you don't really want my notes on the web. They're all the answer is expression in terms of beta. So the two cases of interest are the case where if this n is finite, so that we've expressed the V vacuum as a normalized, or in general normalizable, state in the U-Hilbert space, then it's just, well, then that's just some other state in this Hilbert space, so the two representations are still equivalent. But if this is not finite, if n is 0, because this sum might diverge, then we have two unitarily inequivalent representations. Okay. And so we have some new representation of the field algebra. I should mention that the reason this might diverge is, well, if we're working in a non-compact space, there's a sum over an infinite number of field modes. There could be an infrared divergence, for example. Okay. And what that means physically, if there's an infrared divergence, a common case in which infrared divergences arise in this business is the following. We've agreed these two vacuum states are not the same. So in some sense, when we're in one vacuum, like the U vacuum, that state contains particles defined with respect to the other basis. Now, suppose you're in a non-compact space, and in fact, you preserve some kind of translation invariance. Then what you'd expect is for the particle number to be a constant density in space, right? But the total number of particles would diverge, because there's maybe 5 per unit of space-time volume. All right. What that would mean, then, is that one of these states would contain an infinite number of particles when analyzed in terms of the other creation annihilation operators. And as a result, we would have a unitarily inequivalent representation. OK. All right, this is a good place for me to stop. And tomorrow, we will begin looking at the example of Rindler space, and hopefully provide a lot more physical context to explain the physics behind the construction we looked at today. Okay. Great. If anybody has any more questions, you should catch me on your way out. Yes, David. Hilbert spaces are unitarily inequivalent? So. There is the vector. There is the vector space with indefinite norm, which represents the solutions of the wave equation. Yes. Okay, that's fine. That is the same object. These are just two bases. This is a well-defined change of basis in that case.
Okay.
But the Fox space, these are not unitarily equivalent. That's right. And the issue comes up because this is kind of like a transformation in the one particle space.
Yes.
Okay. And as I say, typical divergences that cause unitary inequivalence have to do with just having an infinite number of particles. So it's at that level that you get this unitary inequivalence. Question?
Yeah, you had mentioned that if you tried to, say, integrate the stress tensor,